So if I were to say, what is a Stoic in an elevator speech? They're the ones who establish a span of control and know that virtue and character from the time they are born to the time they die is all on them as far as making good on their promise to themselves, as Rob Roy would say, that honor is a gift a man gives to himself again and again and again. So Stoic virtue is the ability to exercise good character in all things, to do no harm, to act in a fashion that embraces, I would say, with the Rothbardian non-aggression principle, and also to know that your span of control is such that those things outside of your span of control, why let them consume your finite time on this earth?
Everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to the show. Today's November 14th, and I'm very excited to welcome back Bill Buepert. You can check out Bill's work at zerogov.com, and you can also hear him on The Freedom Fiends at freedomfiends.com. Hey, if you're interested in what we discussed today, please check out the show notes. You can do it at schoolsucksproject.com. Lots of good links, lots of good information available on the topic of Stoicism. And that is the focal point of our discussion today. This is part one of two on this topic. The second will probably follow in a couple weeks. So, identification first. What is Stoicism? I found a nice summary on hackthesystem.com, Stoicism 101, a quick guide to the philosophy. Just for a basic introduction, some of you might find some of this to be a little bit off-putting. But in the next two shows, or the next two shows with Bill, we will flesh this out better. And we will talk about how this is not at odds with what I think many of us already accept or practice philosophically. But parts of this might take many of us out of our comfort zones. And that is a beneficial thing. Stoicism was founded around 300 BC by Zeno, who was born in Cyprus. Zeno lectured from a well-known stoa, a porch-like structure in Athens, hence the name Stoicism. For centuries, Stoicism was one of the most influential philosophies in the Greco-Roman world, and its numerous followers and teachers modified and developed it over hundreds of years. The basic framework, however, has always remained the same. The major goal of Stoicism is to lead a man to arrive at happiness by achieving the true good thing in life, or arete in Greek. This summum bonum, or supreme ideal, is a combination of four qualities. 1. Wisdom, or moral insight. 2. Courage. 3. Self-control. And 4. Justice, in the form of upright dealing with others. The idea of arete is that by following the ideal and achieving it, a man becomes truly self-sufficient, that is, immune to suffering and bad fortune. Arete is a personal characteristic, not one bestowed by class or position. Thus, even a slave who has achieved arete is free, because no man, not even a king, can affect him. All right, hold on to your seats. This paragraph is a little bumpy. While there is no specific God, Stoics often refer to a divine will in various terms. But the basic understanding is that men live in a singular community under the same conditions and restraints. Due to this singular community, man has a duty to live in conformity with the community. This duty is twofold. 1. We should accept and resign ourselves to whatever fate is bestowed upon us without complaining. 2. We should bring out life in accordance with nature's laws. Now, there's lots of dirty words there, conformity, duty, but I want to go into a little more detail about each one of those steps. Step 1, resigning oneself to fate. Why should we accept fate completely? Although this seems to mean that we shouldn't try to improve the future, this isn't correct. Stoics put a high value on public service. Jesus, this person wrote with a lot of strong language, for instance, or striving to better oneself. Let's focus on that one. In the case of Stoicism, resigning oneself to fate means that we should not set too high a value on cursory, transient things. By avoiding a fixation on the unimportant, man can find true inner peace and unshakable contentment that doesn't rely on possessions or fortune. By accepting that things come and go, this contentment and peace will withstand the obstacles of ambition, luxury, and most importantly, greed. It should be noted that the idea that all things come and go is a central tenet of Zen Buddhism as well. Step 2. Life in accordance with nature's laws. The concept of nature's laws is a bit personal, which is why questioning convention is one of the fundamentals of Stoicism. Some of the most important ideas, however, are clear. First, training oneself to live with only the bare necessities. A man should know how to live with just basic food, water, clothing, and shelter. In one of his letters, Seneca writes, "Set aside now, and then a number of days during which you will be content with the plainest of food and very little of it, and with rough, coarse clothing, and you will ask yourself, is this what one used to dread?" And we should develop our gift of reason. How so? We must perfect our sense of reason to conquer our devastating inner emotions, grief, pain, fear, of death especially, and superstition. Reason allows us to escape and discipline our passions. Understand that nothing is good or bad, only thinking makes it so. That's also Buddhist. And to generally accept our mind as a greater source of truth than the body or emotions. So there you go. I hope that is a helpful introduction. Bill and I are going to go into way more detail, and I'm really excited about these conversations. I hope you are too. Oh, hey, this show really needs your support. Like, really, really needs your support if you can manage it. I mean, take a minute to evaluate your lifestyle. I do this. Income, security, possessions, etc. And see if you can afford to come up with about 20 cents a day to help out School Sucks and to keep the show going and growing. I know it's been about 10 days since I put out a podcast, but hey, go to our YouTube channel, School Sucks Podcast, and even browse the AV section of the website. I have been working. I work on School Sucks related things 5 or 6 hours a day, 6 or 7 days a week. This is a job. And the last few months have not brought a lot of good news as far as people coming and going from our AV Club subscription program. I do want to say thanks to Jahida, a name that I said wrong even when I was trying to correct myself for my previous mispronunciations of her name, for her recent contributions. It means a lot to me. I am enjoying working with her and her husband, John, as well, helping them get their own podcast going on the subject of peaceful parenting, as I mentioned before. I want to thank another listener named Josh down in Argentina, who has volunteered his time to help with some redesigns of the website. And of course, to everyone who has contributed $6 or $9 or $12 or $15 a month to keep School Sucks Project going. We are, you should know, one of the more popular liberty-themed podcasts. And as far as downloads per episode go, we pull in more than Free Talk Live. At least that was the case last time I checked with Mark. And that's a big show. As far as shows that are consistently hitting on the issue of education versus government schooling, we are number one, right? So this is an important message, and it needs to continue, and it needs to grow. And we ask for six. It's, like I said, 20 cents a day. And gosh, it seems like such a small amount of money when I say it that way, doesn't it? 20 cents a day? See, this is why I wish we had teleportation. Because instead of, you know, people having to take however long the process is to go to schoolsucksproject.com/AV and sign up to keep the show going, I could just teleport you here. And you just, I call you and I say, hey, I'm going to teleport you now. Grab the pants that you were wearing yesterday. I teleport you here to my office. You shake out your pants onto the floor. You know, I get all your nickels and pennies. I put them in a jar. We high five, and I teleport you back every day. That technology is coming. I'm really excited about it. I really think it's going to be a tremendous boost for the show when I can teleport all the listeners here. But until then, schoolsucksproject.com/AV. And instead of a bunch of nickels, it is a lump sum electronic payment of $6 or $9 or $12, etc. You can see what the levels are at schoolsucksproject.com/AV. Six doesn't sound like a lot of money, but when a lot of people do it, it makes such a huge difference for me, and I am just extremely grateful for everyone who does it. Here's how the show will work. We got my conversation with Bill Buppert on the topic of Stoicism. We're going to do some new subscriber geography trivia. And then after new subscriber geography trivia, there'll be another short segment where Bill responds to a couple of listener questions. So there we go. I hope you enjoy this, and I look forward to your feedback. Thanks, everybody. Take care.
In case you just came in, you're in the middle of an Ignite session. We've got 9 speakers. We just had our 3rd talk. All the talks are the same in that they're 5 minutes, 20 slides, 15 seconds of slides, and the speakers have no control. And our next speaker is a control freak and not used to this. Please meet Tim Ferriss. He's the author of The 4-Hour Workweek, and he's here to talk about practical pessimism.
All right, guys, this is not meant to be depressing. It's meant to be practical. I changed my topic a bit, so hopefully at least perhaps 1 or 2% of you will find this useful. Do a little dance. Oh, we're getting ready. All right, so this is a photograph of Las Leñas in Argentina, where I went skiing with 2 close friends, one of whom recently died of pancreatic cancer. He was in his early 30s. The same day, I received an email notifying me that the 10-year-old daughter of a close friend had been diagnosed with inoperable cancer. And this was very recent, and this produced a profound sense of urgency in me to do bigger and better things in my life and to test new directions before some undefined point in the future. So I want to talk about the most effective pair of productivity techniques that I've come across since 2004. That have helped me, up to this point, test the uncommon despite the fear of ridicule, criticism, failure, and so forth. And both techniques, I cheated a bit with the format, some things we'll repeat, are borrowed from Stoicism, which was a school of philosophy from the Hellenistic period used by a lot of the Greco-Roman educated elite, including emperors and military and statesmen. The first is called negative visualization, and it's all related to the basic assumption that defining your fears instead of your goals is a key to doing anything uncommon, anything big. Negative visualization is what I would call preparation in practical pessimism, and that is defining in excruciating detail the worst case scenarios. So as an anecdote, in 2004 I was working 14 hours a day in my own company, trapped in a beast of my own design, and knew that I had to take a 2 to 4 week retreat to either streamline the business and extricate myself or shut it down because there were issues with exit options. I didn't do that for 6 months because I was running an endless loop of what-if scenarios. What if I missed a notification from the IRS? What if we lost the biggest customer we have and therefore had problems A, B, and C? The problem is those fears weren't actionable, just like poorly defined goals aren't actionable. Then I came across the writings of Seneca, Lucius Seneca, who was an advisor to the emperor in his day in Rome, also what you might consider the most successful investment banker and playwright at the time in Rome. And I performed an exercise that he suggested, which was taking out a piece of paper, in my case, an 8.5 by 11 sheet one evening, and detailing in the first column all of the terrible things, the worst case scenarios that could happen if I did what I was considering, which was this retreat. For you, it might be a change of job, it might be proposing a new project, it might be ending a relationship, it could be any number of things. All of the negative things that could happen. Second column, all of the things that I could do to minimize the likelihood of those things happening. And then the last column were all of the line-by-line actions I could take to get back to where I was then, to re-achieve the status quo, so to speak, maybe getting back into the industry that you would leave to start your own startup, whatever that might be. And in that instant, I saw that on a scale of 0 to 10, 10 being most impactful, I was looking at a unlikely transient pain of about 2 and a potential life-changing permanent change of 10. And I took the trip. I took the trip, and that's why the book happened. That's why the World Championships in Tango happened. Everything that brought me to stand here today, I can trace back to that one evening, that one exercise. So let's move to practice. The second piece, the second technique, is rehearsing the worst-case scenarios. Seneca would put it thus: set aside a number of days each month where you are satisfied with the cheapest and scantiest of fare, meaning food, the roughest of dress, all the while asking yourself, is this the condition I feared? What you're doing is exposing yourself to negative emotions like fear, embarrassment, lack of finances, so that you're inoculated when you later have to make hard decisions ask for hard things or reject, refuse things. So you can act despite these emotions. Cato, who was viewed as Seneca as the perfect Stoic, wore darker clothing than his expected light purple, didn't go with a tunic. He was very out of style in his day. And he did so that he would learn to be ashamed of only the things that were truly shameful and to ignore the millions of things that men would otherwise have low opinions of. So it's very important that you practice your worst case scenario. What you'll find is that many of the fears you have are based on undervaluing the things that are easily obtainable. So those are two techniques that have resulted in the greatest gains, all of the uncommon, all of the big things I've been able to do. And I would encourage you, before trying to define your goals, to focus on defining your fears. Thank you very much.
Bill Buepert, welcome back to School Sucks.
What an honor. Thanks, Brett, for having me on again.
It's my pleasure. Your first appearance, actually, was so well received. I can't believe I let this much time go by without getting you back. But I look forward to doing this a little more regularly in the future.
Well, you're very kind. And I look forward to it, too, because I think that we have a great conversation going in. And while we agree on a lot of things, to a certain extent, it's the disagreement that folks have that can make things interesting. And we can tease those out maybe to form a consensus that is better than before we started.
Absolutely.
Talking.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's really important. Those are some of the shows that I've considered to be the most valuable. Some people are frustrated by them, but I think it's a good exercise.
You know, human beings love storytelling. And for instance, why are soap operas so popular? Because if it weren't for infidelity and infelicitous behavior and lying and deception, there'd be nothing interesting to watch.
Absolutely. Yes, yes, yes. And it's not like I haven't gone out. In the old days of the show, I used to go on these quests to try and find these people. And I found that most of the people that I really wanted to talk to, like the pro public school folks, wanted nothing to do with me. I was just getting banned from their forums when I would try to start conversations. So I'm glad that I found people like Thaddeus Russell, like who are willing to have that conversation. And I'm looking for more of those folks for sure.
Well, if I may, a slight anecdote. In 2010, I debated Dr. Daniel Walker Howe, professor emeritus, UCLA, and Pulitzer Prize-winning historian, on the Constitution versus the Articles of Confederation. And I championed the Articles, and I do think I won that debate because apparently he had looked at my CV and discovered that I was not a credentialed academic nor historian.
Uh-oh.
So I don't think he prepared quite as well as he would have if he thought he was crossing swords with somebody who on paper had credentials similar to his. But what I found fascinating about the whole experience is I asked myself, here I am at Freedom Fest, and I'm a freedom guy.
Mm-hmm.
What would it be like to go to, let's say, Slave Fest, where they bring me on board as the freedom guy to be the token freedom expositor? That would be a blast.
Slave Fest.
That's right. That's what each convention is, whether Republican or Democrat.
Yeah. One of the issues that came up the last time you were on the show, and it was one of the things people wanted to hear us talk about the most when you came back, was the philosophy of Stoicism. The more I've looked into it, I've been pleased to discover that it lines up with a lot of what I already believe, what I already practice. I think as a philosophy, it seems like it's often misunderstood as a kind of emotionlessness or asceticism, a word that I actually learned from Thaddeus Russell, which is basically, you know, a kind of severe self-discipline or abstention from most things pleasurable, usually for religious reasons. But I think that before we get into talking about what Stoicism is, it's important to kind of differentiate between the philosophy and like small s Stoicism as it's used today.
I think so too. And it isn't about being absent of emotion. It's about being able to control your emotions. My wife often accuses me of having Vulcan-like qualities. And she says that, well, you repress emotion or you rationalize it away or whatever the case may be. And or she'll say you're emotionless. Or one of the favorite tropes in my household is they say, oh, Dad, did we hurt your feeling? but it is about reserving emotion for those right times. I mean, we have a finite amount of time and resources to spend in this mortal coil on being virtuous and being good and having these interactions with friends, families, neighbors, that kind of thing. And to me, Stoicism has really been a terrific guide for me throughout my life for living a good and virtuous slices, at least attempting at it. Brett, I have to emphasize that we are, I'm not a religionist, but I do think that to a certain extent, there's a lot to what C.S. Lewis says when he says, we are all fallen and we are all trying to improve ourselves on a daily basis and be better about our relationships with others. And maybe more importantly, our relationship with ourselves, because if that relationship isn't solid and open and one in which you've opened all those doors that go into the darker areas of your psyche and you've come to grips with what's there and you've put them to virtuous use, that's what makes us a whole human being. And that's why I find that of all the philosophical schools that were out there, this is the one that resonates with me personally the most. And there's a lot of writing out there, like you were mentioning, that since our last podcast together, you would examine Stoicism. There's a lot of great stuff out there. I'd recommend, and maybe in the show notes we can include this. Ryan Holiday just wrote a great book called The Obstacle is the Way. And he and Tim Ferriss are friends who wrote The 4-Hour Workweek and other books.
Yep.
Terrific podcast available where Tim Ferriss interviews Ryan Holiday about the virtues of Stoicism. William Irvine wrote a book, The Art of Stoic Living, about living a life of joy. And of course, we can go all the way back in time to Seneca, Marcus Aurelius, and read the original works. I'd recommend those who want to read Meditations by Marcus Aurelius, get the Gregory Hayes translation, which I think is the best one that's out there. But I have a small library of Stoic books here, both on my Kindle and physical holdings of tomes. And it gives me a lot of comfort. It gives me a lot. And I'm discovering new stuff every day whenever I investigate it. It seems simple on the surface, but the more you tease out all these nerve endings of Stoicism, the more stuff you find and the more hidden gems you discover that make your life better on a daily basis.
Yeah, and I'm familiar with William Irvine's book, Guide to the Good Life, The Ancient Art of Stoic Joy.
Yes.
Before we get into too much detail, do you have a way to explain the philosophy to people on, say, an elevator ride?
You know, it's real hard for me to give an elevator speech that speaks to Stoicism, but the illustration I will use is one that's common to all Americans today, and that's cinematic experience, because a lot of us have shared movies. Mm-hmm. I watched the movie Gladiator. I think it's one of the better movies that's out there in the portrayal of the war of the Roman way, despite the ahistorical pretenses and the artistic license. A lot of folks would look at that movie and they say Maximus is the Stoic. Well, Maximus has Stoic qualities, but remember Maximus's, I forget what they call the one who leads his gladiatorial arena at the time, who he teaches under, who actually owns Maximus at the time until he gains his freedom. That man, for which it was his last acting gig, he was the true Stoic in the movie. So if I were to say, what is a Stoic in an elevator speech, I would say they're the ones who establish a span of control and know that virtue and character from the time they are born to the time they die is all on them. Whatever they do in life, it's going to be on them as far as making good on their promise to themselves, as Rob Roy would say, that honor is a gift a man gives to himself again and again and again. So Stoic virtue is the ability to exercise good character in all things, to do no harm, to act in a fashion that embraces, I would say, with the Rothbardian non-aggression principle, and also to know that your span of control is such that those things outside of your span of control, why let them consume your finite time on this earth?
Absolutely. And as far as pleasure is concerned, we will get into a little bit of contrasting Stoicism against some other philosophies. I think the one that it's most commonly contrasted against is Epicureanism. This is not a rejection of pleasure, but it's more of developing an understanding of how to avoid the craving or the clinging.
Yes, negative visualization, which you talked about before we started the podcast when we were just having our pleasant conversation together. You said you didn't call it negative visualization, but that's what you were speaking to.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And negative visualization, which we'll also get into, is confronting the fear, right, of loss, adversity, whatever, and working, not just thinking about it, but working to overcome it, essentially.
Oh, yeah. And you know, to illustrate that very quickly for the audience, let's say you say from Friday afternoon until Monday morning, we're turning off all the power in the house.
Yeah.
And we're just going to practice. oh, your car's been repossessed. This is just a thought experiment. Your car's been repossessed. You're going to walk for the next 2 days of the week.
Mm-hmm.
And you can either really do that or you can imagine it and use those exercises to really realize how many gifts that you have.
Yes. So let's start with this word that the Stoics used, tranquility, which again is another word that might mean something different to us today. But what did it mean to the ancient Greeks or even the Romans? How did they use it?
You know, the way that there are many interpretations of this within the Stoic school, the way I see it, it all comes down to span of control for tranquility. And it all comes down to knowing what's within your sphere of influence and what's without your sphere of influence. In this case, we all know those folks who are concerned with saving the whales or climate alarmism.
Yes.
Or and you know, left or right, even though I hate those terms because I use individualist versus collectivist.
Yeah.
When you can find the tropes and the bugbears that make people's heads explode about that kind of thing. You know, maybe it's a climate alarmist, or maybe it's the negativity of climate alarmists to those who don't believe in anthropogenic climate change, whatever the case may be. What they're seeking to do is control things that are really outside their sphere of influence, to which some people will come back to me as an abolitionist, and they'll say, well, Bill, but you're concerned with a planet-wide change. And I have to say, yes, I am. What I do, and Brett, I think this is what you do, and excuse me for being presumptuous, is you and I are philosophically terraforming the planet one disobedient surf at a time. We're trying to prove out that the way to a better future for everybody is to have a voluntary society, a society that isn't formed by force, but a society that is based on capitalism, free markets, tranquility, I would add that.
Yeah.
And the ability, you know, the glory of capitalism is it's this terrific system that allows complete strangers to get together without violence, exchange goods and services, and both leave with a handshake and they're both better off for it. Government doesn't operate that way. And that's what you and I are trying to change. But I would also suggest that even though that is outside our span of control, we don't really worry ourselves to death about it. For instance, those people who save the whales, you'll see a lot of hand-wringing going on, and they'll get very anxious, and you'll hear them bloviating about it again and again. And I get it. It makes sense to me that it's a cause worth serving. But to me, the cause worth serving is the one that goes back to first principles. And that cause is, how should human beings behave with each other, and how should human society be formed? From my perspective, nonviolence and doing no harm is the only answer.
Yeah, I described this in a podcast, I think, in my first year of doing the show. And I was very pleased when I was reading about Stoicism and I discovered the same idea. And I think I referred to it at the time as concentric circles of influence, right? So at the beginning, you have yourself, which is a very essential place to start. And what I had noticed with a lot of people, probably myself included to a certain degree, discovering the philosophy of liberty and waking up from this world that we're all schooled into, there's a lot of distracting and discomforting emotions that come with that. There's a lot of anger. There's maybe a quiet feeling of helplessness. And for some reason, people, maybe it's because of you know, how they're schooled, they want to start with the institutions or the operations or the aspirations furthest from themselves, right? Some political thing, maybe. And it produces a feeling of powerlessness and smallness, and a lot of people give up quickly after that. And I would say that it's important to start at the other end, the smallest circle being, you know, the self. And then obviously, I don't want to use the word mastery because self-improvement is an ongoing process. But once you are comfortable showing people what you have, thinking that other people might want what you have, you can extend that to friends and family, which would be a relatively close circle, to your community from there, you know, so going from the self essentially to relationships and scaling that up.
You're providing an example. And I think that along with storytelling, examples are so visceral for human beings to look at and say, hey, that's a good example. Oh, that's a lousy example. Boy, that person just can't conduct their affairs worth a darn. Or, you know, what a complete gentleman. You know, everything that we do in our lives when we interact with other people, whether it's virtually through the internet or the conversation you and I are having or in person, People are always making assessments of what our virtue is. I really think that's the truth, whether they admit it or not.
Yes, absolutely. So that idea is essentially not just freedom from maybe these distracting emotions, but getting more of that freedom by recognizing what you're able to change, what you're able to do.
Exactly. Span of control.
All right. So how about meditation? Do you practice meditation as a Stoic?
I do, but I don't do it in a conventional fashion, nor do I do it the length of time that I think would be better for me because I'm so lacking in available free time and such. So I think meditation is terrific. Of course, that's the title, Meditations, by Marcus Aurelius, the Roman emperor, who wrote one of the seminal and magisterial texts on Roman Stoic philosophy at the time. The way I relate meditation is that reading takes place when you take your eyes off the page. We can read a book from start to finish, but if we don't take the time to consider what we've read, what we've absorbed, how it matches against our own experiences, how it matches against the interrogation of other books that we've read on the same subject, then meditation reflection doesn't take place. And of course, to use a hoary cliche from the Greek philosophers, is the life worth living one that's examined or unexamined?
Right. Part of that is facing fear, I would think, as far as the Stoics are concerned.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, maybe we'll say this several times, Brett, but that's one of the fundamental edicts of Stoicism is that if you master fear and you master your span of control, no one can possess you. There's an apocryphal story of a Stoic philosopher who was asked to come to the royal court by an emperor, to which he said, "No, I don't think I'd like to do that." And the emperor said, "Well, I can force you to come." To which, and I'm paraphrasing, the Stoic philosopher says, "Well, you may get my body there, but you certainly won't have my consent, and I will advance my refusal, and all you'll have is a corpse."
Mm.
He's eliminated all fear. And as a matter of fact, I was having this conversation with somebody the other day. When it comes to people who hail from a libertarian, anarchist, or abolitionist perspective, when you strip away everything else, it is fear that is the mortar that makes government able to operate the way it does.
Absolutely. And you mentioned Tim Ferriss. I've been checking out his work, and I've heard him say that multiple times, define your fears. And he says, you know, maybe even before you set your goals, you know your fears. And I think that relates to another thing that you already mentioned, this practice of negative visualization. In the story you just told, the man being threatened had already kind of walked himself through the worst case scenario. And he's like, yeah. Then this will happen, then you'll do this, and then you'll kill me. Yeah. Okay, so I get your threat. I've prepared for that. You know, I've inoculated myself against that weapon you want to use against me.
You know, Solzhenitsyn said that once you've taken everything from a man, he's at his most dangerous point. And I think that this Machiavellian totalitarian surveillance state that both East and West is adopting as a sine qua non of the way they form their governments, you know, it just gets worse and worse all the time.
Yeah.
There may come a time, maybe a tipping point, as Gladwell would tell us, where the critical mass of people who say, you know what, you can chain us and you can do whatever you want, but all you're going to get from me is never my consent and only my refusal. And that's a very Stoic way of looking at things.
Well, let's go into a little more detail on this negative visualization and even maybe apply it to some of the concerns that we might have as libertarians or anarchists or voluntarists or abolitionists or whatever words the people out there are most comfortable applying to themselves. Essentially, imagining the worst case scenario. And that's not just about preparation. It also seems like it's about one thing that I often hear tied to meditation, because this negative visualization does seem to me to be a meditative practice.
I would agree with that.
It results in maybe more gratitude, you know, that meditation and gratitude seem to be tied together in a variety of practices, in a variety of belief systems.
And I think so too.
It comes through here as well that, you know, if you walk yourself through these harsh scenarios and then you can return to like, oh, well, here's where I actually am, you're left with a greater appreciation for what you already have.
Yes.
Negative visualization practice. Have you engaged in this?
I have indeed. I would say that as your audience may be aware, if they've read my CV and my bio, I spent most of my adult life in the Legion serving in the U.S. Army and then the Navy as an enlisted person. And of course, negative visualization is really vital for military folk because there are opportunities for us to assume room temperature as a result of what we do on a daily basis.
Yeah.
So I think that's always maybe at the not the forefront, but always at least in the back of our minds. And those of us who chose to be very conscious about what would happen given the ultimate sacrifice, which is your own death, it may not have been at the forefront, but it was always there at least tickling you in the back and saying, you know, at the back of your mind saying the distinct possibility is there. And it helps to clarify and focus your life by knowing those possibilities may happen instead of putting your head in the sand about it.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's interesting that you say that, the head in the sand, because obviously a lot of us who haven't been faced with frequent life or death kinds of situations, I think it might be easier for us to go on autopilot, you know, to use cruise control in life, because, well, we're not encountering these situations where we have to contemplate these things and suddenly they just kind of, you know, happen to us.
Sure.
Right. So introducing, I think this is a really valuable concept or practice to introduce to people who haven't had that experience, because, you know, I mean, there's been so many times in my life where suddenly something goes wrong. It actually just happened to me like a week ago, like something unexpected happened. It was certainly an imposition. And it was like, well, crap, you know, I wasn't prepared for this. So I think it's hard to be really, really specific about the kinds of things could go wrong. But coming to an understanding of what's valuable in your life and then imagining that being subtracted suddenly and kind of walking through where you would go from there. I know there's this challenge in suddenly having to face a situation. And usually when there is adversity, we can find a way to overcome it. But being better prepared for adversity, I think, has a tremendous amount of value. Because the decisions we make, the plans we make once faced with that adversity could actually wind up being, you know, better, more life enriching.
You know, it's interesting too, Brett, because what you're basically saying is live a volitional life. Don't live life as a pinball.
Mm, exactly.
You know, some people have told me that a large part of good luck is meticulous planning and foresight. Mm-hmm. Well, that being the case, what we discover is that if we do plan for worst case scenarios and those worst case scenarios don't happen, things get a lot better over time.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of like what Ryan Holiday talks about in The Obstacle is a Way, because what he's basically saying is that when an obstacle is in your way, you can go around it, you can go through it, whatever the case may be, but the thing that you don't want to do is shrink from it. And I think maybe this is a universal human trait, and maybe I'm generalizing too much, Brett, but I found that I my failures are my greatest teacher. Those things that I haven't done well, for instance, when I commanded, I had a sign behind my desk that read, if you're operating at zero failure, you are an underperformer, to which I would tell my troops, I'm an overachiever when it comes to that.
Right. You know, related to this, we spent a lot of time earlier in the year working through this Nathaniel Brandon book called The Six Pillars of Self-Esteem.
Yeah.
There seemed to be Wes Bertrand, who did the series with me, we both felt that what we were perceiving was a large rift between what we called libertinism and prudishness, right? And not much going on in the middle.
What I find with hedonists and libertines is that they tend to be pinballs, and they tend not to be the people who say, I am going to live a volitional and direction-led life. I am going to be the captain of my destiny instead of allowing others to do so. Like I don't watch TV, but I hear this thing about Jersey Shore and just this, what I consider to be a very corrupted popular culture in America. Not because I'm a prude, but because of the fact that with Twitter and Facebook and all of these things, and I don't have a Facebook account, all of these things, it makes people live in the now in such a fashion that they forget where they came from and they have no direction for the future whatsoever. And all they're concerned about is the quality of their bacon and how their bowel movement was that morning.
You nailed it. That's exactly actually where I was going. I think it's either this full retreat being, the I don't deserve pleasure or I can't handle pleasure, and that results in one extreme. Or there's this, you know, accelerator to the floor. I think Irvine refers to it as hedonic adaption.
Yes.
Which is essential. And both, whether you're hitting the brakes or hitting the accelerator, both seem to be at least partly the result of a lack of gratitude. Obviously, if you're hitting the accelerator into hedonism, it's like, you know, you're continuously seeking new things or new experiences, even recklessly, as sources of happiness. The other one, the retreat, being like, I don't deserve it or I can't handle it, right? So both seem to evidence a lack of gratitude to me.
I think it's that too, and a constant fight against genetically predisposed addiction. Mm-hmm. I think that all human beings have addiction quotients of one size or another. And by the way, the medical community would just, they'd be aghast at me making that statement, because I don't think it's a disease, by the way. I just think that it's the way people are wired. When I say genetic quotient, I'm talking about psychochemical and even mindful, or for religionists out there, soulful things that they do that cause them to self-destruct.
Yeah.
And to a certain extent, Stoicism gives us a toolkit, a tool set in which they encounter head on, eyes wide open, some of these foibles and frailties that make us human, and they leverage them in a fashion that we can use them to advantage, and we can use them to advantage in a fashion that doesn't make other people the worse off for it.
Yeah, and that also relates to what I was just saying about the – I mean, I really don't want to call people you know, who are recovering from addiction by what have become in the 20th century traditional methods like AA or NA or Gamblers Anonymous, whatever. I don't want to say that's a prudish lifestyle, because it's different, but it's that same – it is a similar kind of retreat. I'm powerless. I have a disease. I'm a pinball. Essentially, which might yes. be a better choice than full speed ahead into, you know, more compensation and more pleasure seeking to deal with the destructive power of whatever, you know, the addiction is that they're already grappling with. Right. So maybe in that sense, the prudishness is better. But Stoicism, which seems to actually have a lot of parallels to something like what is it called? Rational emotive behavior therapy. Which is about practice, you know, and persisting through those challenges and coming up with tools or strategies to deal with those challenges.
It's positive yeah. practice and persistence, where you're trying to do something that is good for you and those around you instead of destructive of you and those around you.
Yeah, but also to borrow a word from, you know, the 12-step programs, that there is an inventory that, you know, that you have to do. You have to know what the problem is.
You're right. And there's four cardinal virtues of Stoicism that are acknowledged, and that would be courage, justice, temperance, and wisdom. And temperance, of course, speaks exactly to what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. And that's a good place for a transition into another attribute of the practice of Stoicism. And that's what Irvine calls training through voluntary discomfort. Can we talk a little yes. bit about that one?
Sure. It's part and parcel of negative visualization. Mm-hmm. And what it is we live in the most affluent society that the world has ever known, you and I in the United States. And it's also got a lot of other negative attributes, but I'm going to suspend those for now for the sake of this conversation.
Sure.
We also have access horizontally and vertically to the greatest amount of information humans have ever been exposed to, period. And what are we doing with that? Not much at all. Are we advancing as a humanity as a result of that? I don't think we are, to the extent that we can. Of course, as an abolitionist, I think that the primary brake on advancing human civilization is the state. You know, one of my friends coined this really witty phrase where he said that the state likes the force so much they must be Jedi, and that's got to be correct, because that's the way they see society organizing itself. But when we take that apart and we look at things, we can say, you know, maybe if we just step back, live our own lives, educate our own children, practice these Stoic virtues, things will be better. And maybe if we consider just how bad could it be? There was a show, a documentary called Happy or Happiness, about mm-hmm. happiness around the world. They went to Calcutta in India. There's this family of, I think it was six, in which they have these bicycle led carts, sort of like a rickshaw, but an Indian variation of that. That's what this gentleman does for a living. Is this gentleman smiling and content and happy in spite of the fact that he lives in what appears to be a 25 square meter shack with open walls. His children are smiling. His wife is smiling. He's smiling. He's content and he's happy, despite when we compare it to the affluence that we have now, people would say, but if he's that poor, if he's that materially insufficient, how could he possibly be happy? And I maybe he didn't subscribe to the Stoic virtues, but I'll bet he knows them inherently and de facto and de jure. He knows that true happiness may not be the result of all the material affluence and affectations and stuff that you get, but it may be, are you consonant with yourself? Are you living in good character? Are you practicing virtue? And are you transmitting that virtue to your friends and family, especially your children, through home education? Since I'm on the School Sucks podcast, I feel I've got to give a shout out for home education, because if there's any Stoic innovation that is really emanating and rippling throughout American society, that is what home education is.
You know, to go back to a couple of things you said, first, this man and his family in India, I think there's a value in making things explicit, right? Because you said, well, maybe he's doing these things, but he doesn't know. And right. It's so much easier to practice the six pillars of self-esteem, let's say, if you know what they are. It's so much easier to practice the virtues of Stoicism if you know what they are, or the trivium, you know, the process that your mind wants to go through naturally, but then to make that practice explicit is enormously beneficial. And that actually takes me back to something you said before, like with all of these, you know, the benefits of being here and now, what are people doing with it? Nothing. Do you really feel like, I guess I'm trying to think of the best way to characterize the phenomenon. Like, is humanity going in the wrong direction by and large? Is that what you see?
I absolutely think that. I think humanity has been going in the wrong direction since the Sumerians started crafting writing and the recording of written characters on tablets for tax records.
Well, the reason why I ask is because I think, you know, I try to observe people. I was actually just on another show and I got asked this question, basically, are we getting smarter or dumber? And it's people would say, well, that's an easy question to answer. But I think that to view things optimistically, you can see a lot of glimmers of doing the right things. You see little flashes of it here and there. It's just that I think a lot of people, with all of the distractions or their own, whatever their difficulties are, they find it hard to make it practicable. Does that make sense? Like, I think people deep down know the right things to do.
It makes sense. So let me amend my remarks. I think that for the most part, everybody on the planet is going in the wrong direction. But I do think there are a select few who are stopping their way forward. They're standing there. They're scratching their foreheads and they're saying, is this what life's all about? Is this the proper way to do things? Because one of the things that I've always held closely and firmly is that my notion of a voluntary society, what some people call anarchy, what I prefer to call abolitionism and the destruction of all forms of human ownership of other human beings, is that the Stoics tell us we own ourselves, we own our lives. As a matter of fact, we own our refusal and we own our consent. And that if we practice that to the nth degree, no government can make us do anything against our will, because our compliance with the government is all about us doing it out of fear and doing it of our own volition, or however we've rationalized that volition. So I do think that there's a select subset of humanity who's, and I consider your podcast to be one of them, and some of the other ones out there in this little libertarian universe, who are stopping and standing and scratching their foreheads and saying, you know what? Forming societies through violence is wrong. Being afraid of a few bad people, and because of that, having this absolutely tyrannical institution of voting to put a few of the worst people in society in charge of every aspect of my life to stop a few bad people from harming me, it's just silly. You know, intellectually, spiritually, emotionally, it's silly, yet we're trapped in this seemingly government perpetual motion machine where we don't see its powers retarded in any fashion. We don't see the brakes put on its ambitions to control every aspect of our lives. But I do think there's folks out there, and Seneca wrote about this 2,500 years ago. Aurelius wrote about it a little later than that. You and I are discussing it today. People who are saying the direction society is going is wrong, and here are some alternatives that we can offer. And by the way, because of our peculiar creed of voluntarism. We don't want to force you to do that. We would like to compel you to do it through cooperation, persuasion, and showing you that we are the virtuous example, the superior moral example of how to behave.
I feel like there's some balance with that too. Like, you know, when I was newer to these ideas, I felt like my attitude was, ha, 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 look at everyone else. You know, like,
yes,
how silly. And obviously, this is something that shows up online in a lot of places, like as far as how people present these ideas. And I try to balance that with this recognition that all of that training, you know, still has a gravity. And if I don't acknowledge that, I can kind of get pulled back into that fear sometimes, and to really have to stop and say, well, wait a minute, is this rational? Where is this coming from? Do you know what I mean? I think that I think it relates to what we've already talked about, but I think it's worth reiating that that's an important
look. It's
practice.
It's not irrational in the least, Brett.
Right.
Because I think that urban centers are the hotbed and probably the embryonic hothouse for socialistic collectivist ideas. And this idea of forming society around violence.
Yeah.
Agriculture did nothing to help that, because what agriculture did is that married up to the urban idea, it allowed governments to take root, quite literally, to use a really tortured metaphor. Yeah. And then from there, what we have is we have this long line of people rationalizing their chains and saying, well, that's just the way things have to be. And that's not the way things have to be. It's simply that when you do something for millennia, it does become hardwired to an extent, even philosophically, in the human condition. And I think that's where we're at now. That's the crossroads we're at now.
Absolutely. How would you suggest that people like us would use the, or could, I should say, use the this voluntary discomfort to be better prepared?
I think as a husband and father, Brett, we have an obligation to provide material, spiritual, and intellectual and emotional safety and comfort to our families. We are abjuring our duty if we don't prepare for contingent events in the future that may be worse than what we experience today. Mm-hmm. Could be a storm, could be an economic collapse, any number of things. Some people call it survivalism. Some people call it prepping. What I think it is due diligence as a father and a husband to take care of my family. So when I mentioned earlier in the podcast, turn off the power to your house for the weekend, and as a family, go through that and take notes. That would be a way to sort of weaponize negative visualization, where you're making everybody experience it with you. You know, of course, if the family agrees to do that. Another negative visualization is walking to work, like I mentioned earlier. Or another one is, and maybe you don't want to practice this by quitting your job, is saying, hey, what am I going to do if I lose my job? I just, you know, personally, I just lost my job in September. And fortunately, as a Stoic, I get down initially and then I say, what obstacle is this and why is this obstacle here? And what advantage can I take? How can I leverage this temporary misfortune, this failure, into something that's going to make me a better person, not only for myself, but for those people who depend on me, like my family, and those people who enjoy my company, like my friends, things like that? How can I not be a miserable person as a result of that happening, but how can I be a better person as a result of this crappy hand of cards that's been dealt me?
Yeah. And I think for a lot of people, and I'm speaking from experience, like, it's a terribly difficult exercise, even to do, you know, the visualization part of it, right? Because the all this discomfort comes in and you say, bah, well, that's not real, you know, and you just kind of back away from it. I'm guessing that the training through voluntary discomfort is the real challenge, actually experiencing what some of these things might feel like, right?
I mean, imagine if you were to go so far as to saying, I wonder, you know, Brett or Bill, what it would be like to be homeless, and we actually do that for a week.
Yeah.
And then I'll bet if we did that, Brett, once we return to our normal life as it is, we would probably have that gratitude that you were speaking to earlier in the podcast for what we have.
Yeah.
To a much greater degree.
Absolutely. And even if we just scale this down to maybe some, you know, personal pursuits, and this is something I would think that could be used to essentially build willpower as well.
I agree. And of course, will is one of the primary forces that Stoicism embraces as that we are born with. No one can take it away from you. No one can do anything with your will but you. And a lot of people rationalize that by saying, well, I'm going to go, I'm a non-voter, so I'm going to use this example. I'm going to go cast a vote, to which I'll say, but why are you going to cast a vote? It's all you're doing is switching plantation owners every 4 to 6 years. Well, I'm going to do my part. Well, I just wrote an essay a few weeks ago called Voting for Vandals, where I asked myself in a thought experiment, why do totalitarian societies have the vote? And why is that vote nearly 100%? Are you familiar with what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, why would that be? Why would you be? You're a totalitarian. You're in charge. You're the dictator. You've got – and it struck me in a brain zephyr that the reason they do that, Brett, is because that way, no matter how monstrous they are in administering things, they use that vote as an excuse to say, well, you're getting it good and hard because you asked for it.
You can only blame yourselves.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. And the reason why I brought up, willpower, I have often thought of the will as almost akin to physical strength, right? The more that this is put into practice, the better the results are.
And well, and I think the other reason, Brett, that the will has suffered some negative publicity mm-hmm. is because of Nietzsche, is because of Wagner, and the association with National Socialism. The association with that radio talk show host G. Gordon Liddy, mm-hmm. who had worked at the White House, he wrote a book called Will, and people have a lot of negative baggage with that, like they do with anarchism and that word. Even though, to me, it represents the purest form of society, which is a voluntary society. In this case, though, you're right. We need to convince people that will is not a bad thing. As a matter of fact, will is the fundamental thing that not only gets you out of bed, makes you do the right thing. But it's also what makes you decide just how far you're going to go to collaborate with the various aspects of totalitarianism that enter your life on a daily basis.
So it's, again, too, there's this distinction that needs to be made, individualism versus collectivism, because the horror show that happened, where Nietzsche was a kind of collective will. Right. I mean, that was the idea they were pushing. I mean, that comes from Hegel, like the spirit of the people, and that gets tied up in this idea that we all have one will, that an ordinary fella, just an ordinary face in the crowd, like Adolf Hitler, can step up and explain it to all of us. But we're talking about individual will. Right. That's not contingent on anybody else or consensus.
I agree. And a large part of Hitler's success was also not only his ability as a speaker, but his master's ability to use storytelling, which I related earlier in the podcast, is one of those fundamental things that all humans are attracted to, like a warm fire on a cold night. He was a master at that. But what you find is a trend line with politicians, who I consider all to be ambitious totalitarians at their core, mm-hmm. no matter what their protestations to the opposite, whether in the US or anywhere on the planet and throughout history, is if they can tell a good story, they can captivate people. They can take the negative and positive attributes of storytelling in both of those attributes and use them to leverage the kind of consent that builds the surveillance state and the totalitarian societies that pepper the planet today.
Yeah, and could we say that partially is the result of weak-willed individuals?
Why don't we tease that out a bit?
Okay.
Because when we say weak-willed individuals, what we're talking about is people who aren't willing to leverage the will that they have in the first place to their own advantage.
Right. From the weak will, I wanted to move maybe not so seamlessly into maybe one of the concerns about Stoicism.
Sure. Yeah.
And I know we mentioned this before we started recording. You said you were not familiar with this idea of hormetism.
I am not.
All right. It's essentially a philosophy that comes from the biological phenomenon hormesis, which states a beneficial effect like improved health or stress tolerance or growth or longevity results from an exposure to a low dose of an agent that could be toxic or lethal when given at a higher dose, right? Now, that's just
it's the basis of modern vaccination.
You make that very general. Yeah, that idea. So there's a blog called Getting Stronger that I read. Yeah. And basically everything on the blog is built around the idea of hormetism, which he credits Stoicism as basically the root of that. The author says it's based on harnessing this biological phenomenon in a deliberate and systematic way in order to increase strength and resilience. So a lot of the things that we've already talked about apply to this as well. One of the critiques would be stoicism, or and maybe this is a mischaracterization, is really about doing the best you can, focusing maybe entirely on internals versus externals. Like instead of saying, I'm going to win at this sporting event, you say, I'm going to do the best I can at this sporting event. But does there need to be some kind of objective standard for success or achievement? And does Stoicism reject that idea?
I don't think Stoicism rejects that idea.
Okay.
I think Stoicism, if the Stoicism takes the Nike ad of do it, and it adds in parentheses, as long as you don't harm others.
Okay. Yeah.
To me, that's the basic creed.
So then from there, we could say it is about empowerment. It seemed like this criticism that I was reading is it's like, no, just focus on yourself and don't worry too much about everything else.
And a Stoic's response to anybody who levied that criticism against them would be, if you wish to do so, that's fine. How could I stop you? You are outside of my span of control.
But does that become dangerous at a point? I guess, all right, so let me try to use some language that would be critical of Stoicism, that you're abdicating connection or engagement, that you're cutting yourself off.
My response to that is that it does all go back to span of one's control. And am I going to cut myself off from things that I think are harmful to me? Of course I am. For instance, maybe there are Stoics out there who smoke, but if they were to examine that, maybe they think that smoking may not be the thing to do. Smoking would be much of an Epicurean thing to do than an Epictetan thing to do.
What you just said reminds me of this interaction that I had with my girlfriend, Allie, a few months back. She's younger than me. She's got a fast metabolism, and she eats a lot of things that are not on the menu for me. And she would, you know, offer me. She actually just was very pleased. We were at the supermarket together, and she found a chocolate cake for $4. And will offer me, you know, some of her treats occasionally. Like, oh, do you want just a little of this? Because, I mean, I think most people feel like, you know, everything in moderation. And my response would always be, I can't, right? That's how I would say, oh, I can't. And saying I can't in those kinds of situations, she pointed this out to me, is kind of like an unempowered or reactive self-denial. So I kind of half jokingly, but the effect was actually interesting. I started, when she would do this, I'd make a fist and I'd say, I won't. And I'd shake my fist. And that sounds like control, you know, more than a kind of reactive self-denial.
But here's the difference between you and I and every other control freak out there on planet Earth is that the Stoic only seeks to control themselves and no one else.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a critical distinction.
Mm. But when we're talking about this voluntary discomfort, the training through voluntary discomfort, do you feel like it produces a kind of, I mean, this is just from my experience with it, a kind of desire to be tested or a willingness to be tested?
I do, because you're aware of it. It's no longer subconscious or absent. It's something that takes on a life of its own throughout your life. I mean, it's because you've assumed a willful life.
Mm-hmm.
You've assumed that you are no longer going to be a pinball and you're going to be in charge.
Exactly. That's a good transition to the sphere of choice. I just want to flesh that out a little bit and make sure.
Did we?
The sphere of choice, which I talked about, mentioning before in an early podcast, something that just seemed intuitive to me, is essentially making a distinction between what we can control and what we can't. Now, the terminology that was used was internals and externals. So how do you define those things? What do we need to know about internals and externals when it comes to the sphere of choice?
Well, I think that it's that what we have to, one of the, I guess you can call it, Stoic tenets would be externals do not amount to happiness. In other words, whatever material largesse is showered upon us, whatever car we drive, whatever house we live in, however people feel about us, however much money we make, in the end, that doesn't necessarily accrue to happiness unless you choose it to be so. In that, if you were a hermit living in a cave as a Stoic, and you had very minimal needs, or mind you, in modern society, if you were homeless, and from a Stoic perspective, that was your happiness quotient, then that's exactly what it is.
Do you think that there's like a practice for not getting caught maybe in the shadow of externals? Because I think that's something that can happen, right? Like I feel in the life I lead day to day, with respect to internals, my needs are met. I'm happy. But sometimes I have an experience where I go outside. I don't want to call it a comfort zone because it's not. But I go outside my normal realm of functioning and I have an experience or I see something. And suddenly I come back to that place. But now I'm kind of being overcome with this concern for these externals, these things I should have, these things I should be doing.
You know, we're in modern society, which is what we speak to because this is our proximate influence. Mm-hmm. Because I can't, while I admire the Stoics, I can't possibly click my heels and time travel back then and then think, well, what would Seneca do? What would Marcus Aurelius do? I have to be in the now that I live in now. Here's an example, and maybe this is negative visualization. Have you noticed, and I think the entire audience can share in this, let's suppose you make 50K a year and all of a sudden a year later you're making 100K a year and you make that for a year and then all of a sudden you go back to 50K a year.
Mm-hmm.
Will a lot of adjustments have to be made for you concerning externals or internals?
Well, I would say both.
Indeed, but internals less so than externals because going back to 50K or going down to 10K or going down to, let's say, worst case scenario is zero, if you can still achieve Maslow's hierarchy of needs, food, shelter, water, all those things, does that stop you from living a full life simply because you can't live in a 64-bedroom mansion or drive a Maserati?
No. Okay, so maybe it's a question. Are you applying the question to everybody, or is this something that you would say for a practicing Stoic? Because I could see somebody's life who is completely unfamiliar with, you know, all of the practices of Stoicism being completely, you know, thrown into a panic by that.
Yeah, and I'd say somebody who's a practicing Stoic, because the practicing Stoic is a single-digit subset of all of humanity.
Well, then I would say from my own
experience— Much like libertarians, by the way, Brett.
From my own experience, you know, I went from making a teacher's salary to, you know, 2.5 times that, and then back to the salary of a professional podcaster. So,
which is not a lot, I take it.
Which is less than teaching. So, and we're working on that, but it's a slow process. Now, those externals were, I think, always overshadowed by the internals, the happiness and the satisfaction. But it doesn't mean that once in a while something doesn't come flying, you know, into my safe area from the realm of the externals. You know, to say, hey, you need to worry about this right now.
Oh, there's no doubt, especially with family and friends and employment.
Yeah.
You know, that those things, you're going to encounter those things on an everyday basis. But I think that there's, and again, going back to earlier in the podcast today, Brett, you were talking about tranquility. A certain tranquility comes from the certitude that no matter what life throws at you, the very worst thing it can throw at you is extinguishing you.
Yeah.
So everything short of that, and this is what negative visualization does, everything short of that is simply an obstacle or a challenge that you either overwhelm, you adapt to, or if you're not a practicing Stoic, you get yourself in the fetal position and you cry a lot and you make mewling noises and you feel sympathy for yourself and you're hoping that other people do too.
Now, how do we not lose touch, though, with those uncomfortable emotions that need to be acknowledged, right? Because there's times where maybe we feel like doing those things, or we feel like those things could happen. You know, maybe the more you practice it, the more those feelings dissipate. But yeah, I mean, I know what that feels like. I don't do it, but I could see somebody curled up in the fetal position crying, and I could say, I kind of know what that feels like.
Maybe most people do, but it's sort of like my attitude about the collectivism that we see in the world today is that when you look at a guy like Paul Krugman, or you look at all of our political actors in American society and such, and you look at all the people who collaborate with those political actors, if you strip it all down, they really do have the creed of an adult toddler.
Mm-hmm.
Because toddler is not a Stoic.
Right.
Because they don't have the philosophical certitude, the temperance to look at who they really are, and to match that up against what they'd like to be. And they don't have, I guess what one could say, the maturity to look at life as a decision point between, am I going to be volitional or am I going to be a pinball? I mean, that really, maybe that distills it all down to what the decision is to be a Stoic, is whether you're going to be volitional or be a pinball. And it doesn't mean that as a result of being volitional, you will have untold success and you'll become a billionaire like Bill Gates or Peter Thiel or some of the other, you know, meritorious folks that we've seen in our society in the last few decades.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean you're going to succeed that way. But then again, to a Stoic, success will be much more internalized and externalized.
It definitely doesn't seem like something that works in a group, right? Which kind of speaks to what you were just saying.
Yeah.
Right? It's not a group pursuit. Doesn't work in politics. It doesn't work in academia. It doesn't work in places where people are used to always getting their way with very little effort.
It doesn't. And there's nothing that says that Stoicism is such a hard philosophy and such intellectual heavy lifting that it's really hard to do it. Because a curious thing that I've come across is that when I look at Bushido in the very isolated Japanese culture, and you look at all the tenets of Bushido and you look at all the tenets of Stoicism, they're very much alike. Yet this occurred in like a stovepipe evolution philosophically, independent of each other. You know, no cross-germination or intellectual sharing whatsoever happened between these two cultures that came up with their own variations of the Stoic life. Now, is Bushido different from Greco-Roman Stoicism? Most certainly it is. But there's a large amount of commonality between that and what the Greco-Romans did.
How do you describe Bushido for people who are unfamiliar? Like, and what most importantly here, like, what differentiates it from Stoicism? What is it and what differentiates it?
I would say the thing that differentiates it the most is the idea of the Ronin and the samurai serving others to the extent of where they will serve others even at the expense or extinguishment of their own life.
Right.
Where the honor culture, and that's not to say that Stoicism is not an honor culture, because I consider it to be probably one of the foremost honor cultures, but I think that the Bushido with the Japanese, they took it one step beyond when it came to the honor culture, to the extent of where we see the tale of the 47 Ronin, and we see so many apocryphal Japanese storytelling and narratives about the ultimate sacrifice was given by the samurai because he considered his life was worth nothing if he wasn't serving either a master or a general or someone else. And because of that, he was willing to give it up when he had to.
That sounds kind of like some other philosophies.
Yes, it does.
It was just a Hollywood movie, right? 47 Ronin?
It was. Then yeah. Remember the ending? Where all but one commit ritual seppuku.
I didn't see the movie. It wasn't on my 2C list either. But I was wondering, knowing just the very, very little about that idea, like, why? How did this get here? You know, what's the point of this movie? What's the message?
And the message in that movie, unfortunately, and Stoicism can be weaponized in the same fashion, is that if you take the power of these two creeds and you use them to ill ends, then you can end up with totalitarianism. Although yeah. I do think that Greco-Roman Stoicism has a built-in antivenin to collectivism.
How so?
Refusal and obedience. I wrote an article in the past year called Question, Obedience, and Authority, in which I said, it's really sexy to say question authority, but if you don't question what actions that authority, which is your obedience, then all you're doing is moving your mandibles.
Yeah.
And I think that when it comes to Stoicism, for Stoicism, one of the central tenets you can tease out of this, even though they don't say it explicitly, is that your obedience and your consent and your ability to advance your refusal to those things you don't wish to comply with, that's a key pillar of the way of Stoic thinking.
We've covered some of the basics of this today, Bill.
That's what this is, yeah.
Yeah,
this is like the freshman year.
Yeah, as far as the tranquility, freedom from distracting emotions, these meditative practices, or the meditative practice of negative visualization and the importance of that, and putting that actually into functional training and experiencing voluntary discomfort, and all of those things relate to the sphere of choice and recognizing the sphere of control. What we really didn't get to was the ethical and rational aspects of the philosophy, which I know is a huge part of it.
I agree. We didn't, although people could divine this from what we were talking about, I didn't say it explicitly, but Stoicism teaches that life is unfair and that there is no moral economy in the world. And the only moral economy in the world exists in individuals internally. And what I find of such great value in those two things is that it sort of characterizes why Stoicism is so consonant and so deep a relationship to my own personal abolitionism. I don't like to call it a political framework because I think political frameworks is what's brought us where we are. My philosophical framework of both Stoicism and abolitionism fit nicely together.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the more I learn, the more I'm finding the same thing. And we've gone into other areas as well, you know, on my show. I mean, I want to be offering value and, you know, we talk about how much school sucks. And we always have to answer this question of, well, what is real education and how multifaceted it is? So we've talked about communication. We even talked about the obvious things like critical thinking and spotting fallacies, but, you know, communication as well. And self-esteem was a big part of that as well. So I'm really always very, very pleased when I look at something new that's really attractive and I see how well, maybe not perfectly, but how well it lines up with a lot of the other concepts that I've embraced and devoted a good deal of time to in the past.
I agree. We don't even have to rationalize it. We don't even have to torture it to fit together as puzzle pieces because they fit together so nicely. And I would also suggest that a practicing Stoic is probably public enemy number one to the government education system.
Oh, I would absolutely agree with that.
Yeah.
There's no powerlessness or reactivity there or paralysis from fear.
That's right. And as far as this not being perfect, of course it isn't. There's nothing perfect in this mortal coil. And I would also say that perfection is the enemy of the good, as we find in so many of the things that we do. May I quote a Greek poet who really sort of summarizes a lot of this Stoicism? You know, I love using quotes because it does two things, Brett. It makes me seem erudite when I may not be. And it allows me to take credit for somebody saying something that was so eloquent. And it makes me look smarter than I actually am.
That's why I love quotes too. Go for it.
It's the Greek poet Aeschylus. And he says, and I quote, "He who learns must suffer. And even in our sleep, pain, which cannot forget, falls drop by drop on the heart until, in our own despair, against our will, comes wisdom through the awful grace of God." Now, of course, this is from a Greek who wasn't a Christian. Most likely he was polytheistic. And he's speaking to a monolithic God. You can substitute it with no God or a polytheistic God, whatever the case may be. What he's saying, though, is that the primary reifier, the primary way that human beings attain wisdom, whether we like it or not, is pain of one degree or another, suffering of one degree or another, failure of one degree or another, because that's how we, speaking for myself especially, learn best is through that way. So what Stoicism is saying is it's saying that pain may be central to the human condition, but it doesn't mean you can't use that pain to attain virtue.
Absolutely. And obviously you're familiar with Epictetus. Is that the correct pronunciation?
Indeed.
In the Discourses?
Yes. Yes.
And there's a quote in there that I wrote down. "Neither a bull nor a noble-spirited man comes to be what he is all at once. He must undertake hard winter training and prepare himself and not propel himself rashly into what is not appropriate to him."
That's wonderful.
And the reason why I wanted to throw that in there is because it really speaks to the internals and externals sphere of control aspect of Stoicism. Epictetus was a slave.
Yes.
Who thought of himself, according to his writing, as having quite a bit of freedom and moral integrity, you know, despite the fact that he obviously had very limited control over all of the externals in his life.
All the externals.
Right.
But he showed that even the slave man can be free if he refuses.
Indeed. So, Bill, do you have time for, and we will, you know, we can pause there for now and pick up the other pieces of this in a part two. Do you have time for a lightning round to deal with some listener submitted questions?
I do indeed. And I just wanted to thank you for the, what I think is an invitation. to come back for part two to discuss Stoicism, because I have found that while I've been libertarian, while I've been an abolitionist, and I speak to that quite vociferously on my blog and podcasts and things like that, this is what really strikes home for me. I mean, if a novitiate came to me and say, how can I make my life better? I'd love to say, become a libertarian, become an abolitionist. I can't answer it that way anymore. And maybe throughout my life, I could never really answer it honestly that way. I would always tell them now, once you pursue Stoicism and you grok it and you get it and you read it, you're going to come to abolitionism anyhow.
I agree. And I think another way to look at that same thing is that what kind of foundation do you need to take this stuff on? Because whether you want to go up against traditional views about government or traditional views about religion, you might wind up turning a lot of people off, you know, if you don't have the emotional foundation necessary to take on things that are so widely approved of, you know?
Yes.
So I really see this. I'm kind of disappointed that I'm just discovering it now, but I'm glad that I am. And there's so much valuable stuff here that I think will make me in the future a better messenger.
Well, you know, and for your audience, I'll bet they can spend less than $100, especially if they have a Kindle, on the various works that are out there. And I'm going to send you some lists for your show notes.
Great.
Book lists of recommended reading and maybe recommended listening, like that Ryan Holiday podcast with Tim Ferriss. For less than $100, I know this sounds ambitious. I think people can turn their lives around.
Yeah, absolutely.
I do. And this is conjoined so adroitly and so elegantly with the reason you started your podcast in the first place, which is education, both home education, self-education, and maybe all the other variations on that in which people who are really concerned about improving their lives take part in. This is just, it's married to it so nicely.
I absolutely agree. And like I said, I'm so enthusiastic about figuring that out the more I get into it.
New subscriber, geography, trivia, you just say a person's name and they tell a fact about where they live.
Named after a suspected murderer. Let's start today with Rodrigo S., who is from Jackson Heights in Queens, New York. You know, people often ask me, Brett, how many degrees of separation are there between Jackson Heights, New York, and the Pledge of Allegiance? Great question. I'm surprised by how often that is asked. Well, let's go through that process. Jackson Heights, New York, is believed to be the first Garden City community built in the United States as part of the International Garden City Movement, which began at the beginning of the 20th century. This was a method of urban planning that actually has its roots, if I may, in the United Kingdom. Garden cities were intended to be planned, self-contained communities surrounded by these green belts. And the idea was that each community would have a proportionate area for residence, industry, and agriculture. Green belts, and this larger Garden City movement, was inspired by the utopian novel Looking Backward by Edward Bellamy, a socialist, who first published the book in 1888 to share his view of an ideal year 2000. Edward Bellamy's brother, Francis, wrote the Pledge of Allegiance, and that's how you trivia. Moving on to Gregory P., who's in Ashland, Massachusetts. I've been there, and, you know, we missed it this year, but mark your calendar for next year when I hope to see you all at Ashland Day. It's typically held the third Saturday in September, and man, do they have some festivities near the center of town at Stone Park, which is named after a suspected murderer. You can buy things, you can go on carnival rides. Now, at the end of Ashland Day, they used to set off fireworks atop the old dam there at Hopkinton State Park. But there's been some budget cuts lately, so our fingers are crossed for the future of Ashland Day. Hey, they've got ghosts there too. Remember that suspected murderer I was talking about just a couple of minutes ago? According to legend, John Stone's Inn, which is today called Stone's Public House, has been the site of numerous hauntings. The captain, John Stone himself, allegedly killed a New York salesman. It was an accident. He hit him in the head with a gun when he suspected the salesman was cheating at poker. So in an effort to keep it a secret, Stone and the others who were playing poker buried the salesman's body in the basement. And to this day, people say they see the ghosts of not just the salesman, but the three other players involved in the poker game as well. No body has ever been found. There was also a girl who was hit by a train in 1862, and she wanders around as a little spooky apparition as well. So if you're ever in Ashland, Massachusetts, you know, watch out for ghosts. They will get you if you're not careful. Continuing on to James C., who's in Brooklyn, New York. All these people that I've done today, they signed up for the AV Club in July of this year. What kinds of things were invented in Brooklyn? How about the deep-fried Twinkie? Gross. Sweet and Low. Gross. Teddy bears. Gross. And America's first roller coaster. How about this? In 1946, the first credit card was used at Flatbush National Bank. Hey, you've had Nathan's Hot Dogs, right? They also originated in Brooklyn. They first appeared at a hot dog stand opened in 1916 by a Polish immigrant named Nathan Handworker. Ooh, that's a great name for a hot dogsman. Moving on to Rob B. from Brookings, Oregon. Listen to this. In September of 1942, Mount Emily, near Brookings, became the very first site in the United States to have an aerial bombardment during wartime by the Japanese. So Japanese pilot Nobuo Fujita flew over in a float plane and dropped bombs, which started huge fires in the forest outside Brookings. Fujita was actually invited back to Brookings in 1962, and he presented the town his family's 400-year-old samurai sword in friendship. The town made him an honorary citizen shortly before his death in 1997. Now, many of you are probably saying, what the fuck is up with that, right? But it gets even weirder. The town was home to Elmo Williams, a film and television editor, producer, and director. In fact, Williams was one of the editors on Torah, 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 a 1970 film about, guess what? The Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. You cannot make this stuff up. T-R-I-V-I-A trivia. Hey, everybody. Before we go into this next portion of the show, just a quick comment. I was listening back to this when I was editing, and I said to myself, I don't like this. I don't like the way this sounds. And this is not a critique of Bill's response or of the question that was asked by Sarah. It was more about me not feeling like I did my job as the question asker and, I guess, leader of the conversation to provide more details and a more complete answer. And it was a question that was not exactly this, but relates to something that's been asked over and over again. Why are there not more female libertarians, anarchists, voluntarists, etc.? So I thought about it most of the morning, and I realized I actually have a lot to say on the subject, but I thought that it would be more appropriate to wait for Bill to be back on the show and we can go into this topic and this question in more detail. Many of you will not love this portion of the conversation. If I can just ask you to be patient, Bill and I will get into it next time and I will do my job raising more questions. I have never liked the question. And this, again, like I said, not a commentary about Sarah's question because it's not exactly what she asked, but I have never liked the general question, why are there not more female libertarians? I obviously don't think that one of the goals of the political portion of the libertarian movement should be to rake anyone in as a group, right? Other political movements are very good at that. And I understand that obviously libertarianism, small l, is philosophical, but for a lot of people, it's political first. And that's part of the problem, I think, when it comes to sex disparity, even though it's not, we'll talk about this next time, it's not as significant as you think from a lot of the studies that I've seen for men to women. You'll hear me say in my answer about 4-1 from my experience in the Free State Project. But nationwide, the gap is not that significant as, you know, 4-1. But it seems to me when we're talking about groups and attracting groups, it's just antithetical to a lot of the philosophy like, hey, all you people who look like individuals, you're actually a group with common interests And, oh, you're also victims, and here's how we can help you. Libertarianism doesn't really offer that, or I hope that's not a message that's coming through and trying to attract new people. So I really just wanted to add some comment about my lack of satisfaction with the way I dealt with this. Seamlessly connecting this question, which was about women generally, to feminism, which is missing a lot of steps and a lot of information. And I also didn't like how we just quickly moved on to a next question and wind up talking about how good Jeffrey Tucker looks. So I felt like this deserved more time and attention and thought, and I didn't provide it, but I will do so in the future. All right, here we go. Excuse me. All right, we have three questions, and this is a new thing I'm trying with our group. When I know I'm going to have a guest that people have enjoyed in the past, first one comes from Sarah, and she says, Bill said something on your last show about his daughters not coming around to anarchism. He said something that sounded like he was attributing this to their gender. Maybe he'd like to expand on that.
Well, Sarah, thanks for the question, and I'd like to contribute that to their sex, not their gender, because gender is a grammatical term, and sex would be the term that we would enjoin here to answer your question. And I do think that there is an estrogen quotient to the acceptance of a stateless society. I think that there is a difference between the sexes, and one of those differences is that the yen for security and the yen for having the ability to ensure that the children are safe, well taken care of, well succored, and all their material aspects of their lives are taken care of, not only today, but into the future. I think it sort of causes a reluctance on their part to really examine why government shouldn't exist in the first place. Now, whether this is because of an education deficit, whether it's because of a natural predilection for that security, whatever the case may be, there's some interesting stuff out there to read and try to grok about this. John Lott, who wrote More Guns, Less Crime earlier in his academic career, did an exhaustive and comprehensive study of all the county voting records from suffrage forward with a simple question. And of course, the answer to this question was correlative instead of causative, which is how most social science is done, because causative certitude is very hard to come by for that. What he discovered, though, is that they tended to vote for more government than less government. And by the way, for those in your audience who just experienced this grand old Politburo wave of success where they've taken over the House and the Senate, don't hold your breath for more freedom, because it ain't coming. From 2000 to 2006, the White House and the Senate and the House were in GOP control. We did not see an expansion of freedom and liberty. We saw everything continuing in the opposite direction. I do consider this Bush's fourth term. Mm-hmm. So with that corrective in mind, I do think that when I go anecdotally to freedom conferences, whether it's Libertopia, Pork Fest, the Freedom Summit, various things I've gone to, the number of women who attend the conferences tends to be severely less than the men who attend the conferences.
Yeah, that can be quantified by my experience too here in the Free State Project. It's about 4-1, men to women.
Sarah, it's a great question, and I did mention that, and to me it's an anecdotal quandary. I can't assign any specific metrics to why that's the case, but my limited powers of observation tell me that men are more attracted to the stateless idea than women are.
And my thoughts about it prior to this discussion, there is a kind of what I'll just sum up, and obviously I'm neglecting a lot of science by using such a, you know, simple phrase, but a kind of maternal instinct that is healthy and beneficial, but it's kind of been turned against the family by training.
Yes.
To a certain extent. You know, boys and girls are sorted by the school system and taught different things. And sometimes it's very subtle, sometimes it's not so subtle. But I think that, you know, my short answer to Sarah's question is there is a nature aspect to this and there is a nurture aspect to this. And what is a positive natural aspect of women has been kind of turned against them and turned against us all, I would say, by training to a certain extent, right? I mean, one of the goals of feminism was to replace fathers with government. And that's showing up in the polls.
And we've seen what that's done.
Yeah.
You know, for instance, in the inner cities, when you take the father out of the equation and the government almost vociferously and through merit or lack of merit, considering your perspective, goes after fathers in the home, what happens to the young men who aren't, you know, one of a father's primary jobs is to teach his sons how to creatively channel their naturally aggressive energies.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't call it job one, but certainly it's one of the most important in that bundle of jobs that we have as fathers. And in the inner city, they had none of that. So what you would have is you would have 12, 14, 15, 16-year-old men age banding, much like the schools and gangs, in which that's where they would get the wisdom accrued on how to conduct themselves properly, which is an impossible equation.
Yeah. And in the last 50 years, the signal that's been sent is that, you know, once an egg is fertilized, father, your job is done. You know, we'll take it from here. I mean, I understand the inner city, but most of the experience I had around people on welfare was in small town Vermont. But that's the message that this system has taught to the last two or three generations in the inner city and beyond. All right. Then we have a question from Andrew. He says, men's fashions of the 1920s and 60s. That's his topic. Bill seems to like that subject quite a bit. I've heard him bring it up more than once on Freedom Fiends. He just wanted us to discuss it.
Okay. When it comes to men's fashions from the 1920s to the 1960s, which is what Andrew's question was, men's fashions from the 1900s to the 1960s fascinates me. And the reason I locked down my interest, and my interest sort of takes a very precipitous fall in the 1960s, is for this very simple observation. I am not the most fashionable guy. I'm fascinated by it. But I found that if I wear anything from the 60s or 70s today, Brett, I am the laughingstock. If I dress like Fred Astaire, I command a room.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
That's the distinction. And I love tuxedos, by the way. I urge every gentleman should own at least three or four or five or six. I happen to own, I think, five tuxes. And by the way, don't spend a whole lot of money on them. Go on eBay. You can put together a terrific tuxedo ensemble for less than $100. And once you've accoutered yourself with that, you become familiar with the proper dressing of a tuxedo. No matter where you go as a man, whether you're going to a New Year's Eve gala, you're going to a business conference, whatever the case may be, you will be the one people pay attention to and listen to because they say, you know what, look at that guy. Not only has he dressed in a very classic and smart sense, he dresses in a fashion that commands my attention.
Interesting.
And that's important, and that's pretty much what fashion is. But I do have one corrective when it comes to fashion. I think fashion is conformity, and conformity betrays individualism, and it sort of almost smothers it, which is why when I've been in the Middle East, what I've noticed is when you have women in burqas who are dressed head to toe in black, they will adorn the cuffs, they will adorn the hems, they will adorn the visors with tiny gems. Or they'll put sequins on them, or they'll put just the most subtle color difference on there because they're trying to establish their sort of lack of conformity to the herd. I mean, you know, if you think about it, the burqa and the hijab are probably some of the most extreme fashion totalitarianism that's ever happened on the face of the earth. Yet they're trying to individualize it to a certain extent. So I like, you know, the suit that we have today accrues back to English royalty at the end of the 19th century. And it's amazing how long that has been with us and how little it has changed.
Yes.
If there's any changes, it takes place in the width of the lapel. It takes place in the drape of the rear. It takes place in, does it have bi-panels or does it have no panels at all on the rear? What, you know, how is it? But from foot to collar, for the most part, it's almost identical to what you would have seen in the late 19th century. And I think that doesn't only speak to its elegance, it also speaks to the timelessness of it and the fact that it works.
Yeah, I remember in the 80s, things got a little wild for a bit. But
yes, they did.
People were rolling up the sleeves of their sport coats and whatnot. But we recovered. And yeah, you're right. That has been a mainstay for over 100 years now. It reminds me of a conversation that my live show co-host Osborne and I had with Jeffrey Tucker. We have him on the show.
Who was a talk about a man who bedecked in sartorial splendor. That would be him.
But he talked about fashion as nonconformity, that yes, he wants to follow some traditional rules for looking good. but then he puts his own touches on it, like using detachable collars, double-breasted suits, which are really not considered, I think, by and large, to be in fashion anymore. But every time you see Jeffrey Tucker, he's wearing a double-breasted suit. And
he has a signature look.
Yes.
And I think he's right. He has a signature look that really stands out. As a matter of fact, maybe if you saw Jeff and for some reason you saw him in a room and you were at a libertarian conference and you saw him in a room and for some reason you couldn't see his head because of an obstruction or something like that, but you saw what Jeffrey was wearing, you would know it was Jeffrey Tucker.
Absolutely. I totally
agree. So I think it sort of proves the point he was trying to make.
Absolutely. Interesting. So there is one more question from a listener named Justin, but it's not a lightning round question. It's about home education. And I really feel like at the end of our next show, we should devote some substantial time to that. I can preview it now. He says, as a parent, I want to hear how Bill managed home education. He balanced the classical approach in unschooling. And I don't believe you've ever covered this in detail before. This is definitely the most balanced approach, and I agree fully with his sentiments on radical unschooling. So I think that's something that deserves more time than a couple of minutes, and maybe we can put that at the end of the next show.
I would love to entertain that question, and I do want to put one caveat out there, and that's this. I was the exchequer for the home education of my children. I have 5 children, mm-hmm. and I have 1 remaining at home now. My wife bore the brunt and did a splendid job of educating our children. I worked at the periphery and I provided support staff and everything like that. But any successes that we had in homeschooling, I give to her.
So we can discuss what your observations were in the next show. So, Bill, thank you so much for all of your time and all of this great information. I'm really, really excited about this topic, and I will know more the next time we talk.
Super. I look forward to it. Well, I'm honored as always, Brett, when you have me on your show, and I look forward to future conversations.